books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood and I'm once again at the Boswell Book Festival as we travel the Caledonian Road and listen to some Beethoven with a newsreader. Plus, we'll find four new biographies entering the RNIB Talking Book Library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
Coming up today, former host of ITN's News at 10, John Sushi, goes in search of Beethoven, a deeply personal account of how Beethoven's life and music have become the great passion of his life. And up first, let's hear from author Andrew O'Hagan on the future adaptation of his 60-character epic, Caledonian Road. Andrew O'Hagan had a special keynote event at the Boswell Book Festival, sponsored by RNIB Connect Radio. He gave a sparkling address on humour, using his own work and the great traditions of homegrown satire, from Burns to Billy Connolly. The comedians of Scottish home life O'Hagan sets out on a personal journey to prove that performance is the cornerstone of his own writing and Scottish national literature. He also spoke about his book Caledonian Road, the story of one man's epic fall from grace, which is set to be adapted as a new Netflix show. Before I ask Andrew if there's a part for him in this epic drama, let's hear a clip of Caledonian Road, read by Michael Abubakar.
Tall and sharp at 52, Campbell Flynn was a tinderbox in a Savile Row suit. A man who believed his childhood was so far behind him that all its threats had vanished. He had secrets and troubles, yet out of the cab window St. Paul's was shining on Ludgate Hill and the angels of London were on his side. On reaching Shaftesbury Avenue, he inhaled his own scent, the faded peaches of Mitsuku, and looked up at the buildings. "A reborn dream," the Marquis said above Les Miserables, and he enjoyed the sensation of applause. Oh, the progress of guilt and vanity in the average white liberal of today. Campbell didn't take people half as seriously as they took themselves, which was the first of his huge mistakes. The second being the proof copy he carried that day in his briefcase. At Piccadilly Circus, he passed under a giant video advertisement, pink-haired Korean boys dancing in the sun, which slid to a second, Own the Streets, promoting training shoes. Campbell stared through the glass roof of the cab, thinking of Elizabeth happy in the countryside while he had to deal with the hazards of city life. He liked to believe that what experience had given him was a habit of self-control.
So that's a clip of Michael Abubakar reading from Andrew O'Hagan's Caledonian Road. Tell us about Caledonian Road.
Sometimes you find yourself writing a book because, and primarily you want to read it, you know. I wanted to find out myself what would happen if I put together 60 characters from different walks of life in 2020s Britain, London specifically. And so that was the challenge. And I just got down to it and then found myself wrapped inside the story of one man, a Scotsman in London, who was a success, published author, you know, lives in a fantastic big house in Islington, but there's something wrong at the core of his life, and the reader finds out in quick measure what it is.
The driver's GPS panel said Thursday, 20 May 2021. Temperature 16 degrees Celsius, bright, then showers. The cab stopped at Hatchard's. His modern biography of Vermeer had been published during lockdown and had given him a profile that stretched far beyond his field. He could remember a few passages from the reviews word for word. It is rare in the history of art biography to see a pure enigma so vividly etched out of the darkness, the Times said. A work of mesmerizing empathy, the Financial Times called it, engaging with the soul of art itself. His book appeared to its many readers to argue that unknowability is an essential feature of the artistic life, and perhaps all lives. He had also become a little famous among the young on account of a BBC podcast that often went viral, Civilization and Its Malcontents, a deep dive into the era's shallows. And yet the worry he carried with him, almost constantly, was about money and his failure to be as well off as he should be.
Now, your talk today was on humour. Do you use humour to sort of get the reader into a certain place so you can then do something else with them?
I think humour is the best warm-up for any sort of literary experience. If you can win your readers over with humour, with a tone even, which is just warm and humorous and sees life as being, yes, serious and sometimes tragic, but cousin to that, adjacent to that, always in my mind, is the possibility of humour, you know? And I don't really know many human situations, including dark situations, where humour is impossible. I love always finding the other way of looking at it, and I think readers love that, you know? After all, some of our great social commentators, the Dickenses of the world, the Trollopes, the Jane Austens, they were essentially comic writers. Mm-hmm. And I've learnt a lot from them, I think.
Now, you've been all around the world with the book, but it does have Ayrshire at its heart. Has that been hard, especially when the book's been translated into different languages?
It's been important to try and preserve as much as possible that tone of voice, that way of speaking that is Ayrshire born, it's Ayrshire bred, it's got this part of the world right at its beating heart for me. So when it comes to putting that book into French or German or Italian or Polish or whatever, you know, 20 languages, I've got to work with those translators to make sure that however they manage it, they somehow get to preserve the way of looking at life, the use of language and humour. They may be using different words, but I want them to find words that are equal in weight and comedy to what I've tried to do. You know, it's a hard task, but I think readers abroad really get a sense of Ayrshire from these books.
Now, we had the wonderful narrations at the start of this interview. Were you responsible for the casting of the actor for the audio version?
I was responsible for talking to him when they came up with him as an idea, and I went to sit with him. We had a lunch together, and I could tell from the way he was talking about the book and the various voices that were emerging that this guy was going to be terrific. Michael Akubobar is going to be an actor to watch for a long time, I think. He's presently to be found on stage at the Globe Theatre in London. A month or two ago, he was in a production at the Almeida. He's just a terrific actor. And to take on 60 voices and give each of them, you know, real character, a real heart. There's blood in those characters as he presents them, you know? And that's a really huge task. I don't take credit for that. That's absolutely his talent.
After signing a mound of his magnum opus, with its debt to reality, improvisation and surmise, he left Hatchard's and was walking towards the corner of Fortnum's when he saw, coming towards him, Yuri Baikov, the son of the crooked Russian businessman Alexander Baikov. He had met him several times at social functions, and he was walking with the actor Jake Hart Davies, a handsome young man he'd seen in magazines and on TV. The actor was taking up a lot of space on the street, or so it seemed, and how it always seems with people interested in their own privacy. "Hello, Professor Flynn," young Baikov said. Elegant, camp, with short peroxided hair, he introduced the actor, and they all shook hands. The pair had just been to the London Library and were carrying books on Shakespeare. "Bit of a project," Hart Davies said. "We're going down the mine shaft of human experience." "How lovely," Campbell replied. He looked at Baikov. "I'm amazed you've got time for plays, what with buying up mansions for your old man." "You are hilarious," Yuri said with a swish of the hand. Harrow had given him a rattling English accent, but his mind was Russian.
Having heard you read from it today, did you ever consider reading the audio version yourself?
I did that with Mayflies. I was the narrator of the audiobook for Mayflies, and that was much closer to my own voice, to my own experience. Whereas with this, given that there are young you know, characters of colour, you know, young boys in gangs in London and so on. I thought it would be sailing too close to absurdity to have me, a 56-year-old Scotsman, take them all on. It wouldn't have been impossible. I might have passed muster with a certain number of them, but I just felt that it was a professional actor was needed, and one that had a foot in many cultural camps, and that is what Michael brought to it. You know, a real sense of how to do those voices.
Now, we've talked in the past about your work with blind veterans and how audio describing scenery for them made you a better writer, in your own words. But considering the subject of today's talk, they must have been a bunch of really funny guys.
Oh my God, the blind ex-servicemen that I worked with in the early 90s, who then were part of St Dunstan's, later, as you know, renamed Blind Veterans UK. But they were essentially men at that time, still survivors, some of them from the First World War and certainly the Second, but also wars around the world, Northern Ireland, Sudan, elsewhere. And these men were some of the funniest men I ever met. Talk about polishing your put-downs, polishing your sense of comedy. Those guys were very, very deep believers in the notion that nothing is off-piste, nothing is off the agenda as far as comedy goes. They would laugh at anybody, especially themselves. And these were men, you know, living a life that involved dealing with either partial sightedness or sightlessness, and yet it hampered them not a bit. If anything, their condition increased their capacity for comedy. That's certainly the impression I got. These guys were constantly up for it, slagging themselves and each other, and certainly me. I was the main butt of their jokes as a young 21-year-old. But I miss those guys, and they did, as I said before, they taught me so much about language, listening. You know, the thing that some of your listeners well understand better than I could express it is the importance of listening, of sound, you know? And sometimes sighted people aren't quite listening to the same extent. I've found that again and again. They take what they see with their eyes for granted, and they miss nuances, sounds, changes in tone or temperature in the speaking voice. So, those guys taught me a hell of a lot.
It's a moot point because I know the answer to this question, but now that it's in audio, it's available for people without sight. Is that important to you?
Oh, it's absolutely crucial. I can say with a whole heart, I would not allow a book of mine to be published now if there wasn't an accompanying talking version, because I've got too many very important to me, listeners, readers, who experience it through the talking book, you know. And by the way, some of those people, you know, are without sight, and some of them are sighted. Mm. It's not the big issue. It's an absolutely crucial experience for an author now to hear their work read, but especially with regard to people who are without sight. Given that I've worked with people who are like that, I would want to make sure always that my books were available to them. I couldn't stand it. You know, I'd be tempted to go around to their house and read it myself to them. You know, it's just a big part of my own life and my own, a very important part of my readership, my listenership, as I see it.
If Caledonian Road was to find itself in a different format, say on TV or on the big screen, would there be a part in it for you?
I certainly hope so, and I'm not signing any bits of paper until they agree to let me, if not be the star of the show, at least somebody walking past the camera for 10 seconds, as I did in my previously adapted novel, Mayflies, which is adapted a couple of years ago by the BBC. Now, joking aside, I mean, I'm just so thrilled that the discussions now are at a really advanced stage for turning this into a big returning TV show. And I think it was in the bones of this story from the beginning that it could be visual, it could be, you know, adaptable. So I look forward to seeing what they do. And, you know, to answer your question directly, they bloody better find a part for me, or else I'll be throwing all my toys at the prom.
Campbell knew all the stories. How this kid had always wanted to break from his corrupt, Putin-fearing father to form his own circle. One of Campbell's oldest friends was William Byer, a businessman caught up in a worsening financial scandal. Byer's son, Zach, had gone to Oxford with some of this same set. It was a small world, and all the tales had come hurrying back down the M40 of partying and experimenting and being hog-whimpering drunk. Not Zach, who was now an intelligent, passionate advocate of Extinction Rebellion and too much derided by his parents. He said that Yuri had only got into St. John's because his father funded a chair in climate change studies. If pollution was an Olympic sport, Campbell remembered Zach saying, Alexander Bykov would be Usain Bolt. Faster than anybody, Bykov is killing the planet stone dead.
Caledonian Road, along with many other Andrew O'Hagan works, is available from the RNIB Library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And we'll have more from Andrew O'Hagan later on, as I ask him for the books of his life. Still to come, John Sushi will go in search of Beethoven. But for now, in the spirit of the Boswell Book Festival, the world's only festival dedicated to memoir and biography, let's go in search of some memoirs and biographies that are new in the RNIB library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. Always Winning by Ashley Walters was donated by Penguin Random House.
A scream, then a struggle. Four hard blows to the chest. The final one causing him to cry out. He slumps back against the wall, slides down it. The sound of tires screeching, then silence. The boy holds his hands to his stomach, panting. I can see the whites of his eyes, wide with fear and pain. Blood pools on the concrete. That's it. The sound of people letting their breath out. The stabbed man stands up, smiling. Someone puts a coat around him. People begin to bustle about, moving lights, talking into headsets. But I stay, looking at the blood on the concrete. Fake, this time. Syrup and food colouring. But 15 years before, and the blood had been real. The blood had been mine.
From Adolescence and Top Boy to So Solid Crew, Ashley Walters' explosive on-screen performances and trailblazing music have always explored the same conflicting forces that governed his life. Born and raised in Peckham, his father in and out of prison, Ashley found the gang culture in inner-city London inescapable. At 15, he was stabbed in the neck and left for dead. At 18, had a gun held to his head as he cradled his newborn son. At 20, he was sentenced to 18 months in prison. In this brave and inspiring book, Ashley opens up about his turbulent past. He writes candidly about his battles with identity, addiction, family, and fame, and the realization that after years of struggle, only he could change his future. Always Winning is a framework Ashley developed to turn his life around. Revealed for the first time in this book, explored through powerful stories from his life and career, he shares the principles of this philosophy and shows how anyone can use them to overcome their own challenges, helping them to align a true sense of purpose with inner happiness and personal success and fulfillment.
I was 15, and we had been heading to a youth club near my school. They would sometimes set up disco lights and try and turn the hall into a mini nightclub. DJs would bring their records to spin on the decks. And there was a microphone too. This was around the time Garage was coming up, and I fancied myself as an MC. A few kids in my class encouraged me to get involved, as they knew I had been writing too, and rhyming over jungle beats for a while. So they wanted to hear what I had. A few of us stopped at an off-license, as we usually did, to try and buy a drink. Sometimes we would get served, or find someone else to buy it. But other times, the shopkeepers were having none of it. I can't remember if we were successful or not. But I recall leaving the shop before my friends and heading off towards the youth centre. That night, I was eager to touch a mic. I must have got about 20 metres up the road. When I looked back, I saw arms flailing and heard shouting and arguing. There was some kind of disagreement with two bigger men. I started walking back to the shop to see what was going on. When I reached them, I stepped forward, put on a screw face, and tried to make myself sound more aggressive. But they could hear the reservation in my voice when I tentatively asked, "What's going on? What's the problem?" The sweetest right hand to the centre of my face let me know that my intimidation ploy had failed miserably. The connection from the punch sent me to the floor. Me and my friends tried to put up somewhat of a fight. But our little secondary school selves didn't stand a chance. We got dispatched.
Always Winning is available from RNIB Library as read by the author and runs for 6 hours and 44 minutes.
Dave and Me, Life With and Without My Hairy Biker by Lily Myers, was given to us by Penguin Random House.
My name is Lily Myers. You probably won't know me, but I'm sure you'll know my husband, Dave. This book is about him, our journey together, and now, sadly, my journey without him. Most of all, it's a book about life and an unquenchable thirst for it. It's about the magic Mr. David Myers brought into this world, his joy, his uniqueness, his burning flame. It's a happy, meaningful story of a life like no other. My memories of Dave as a creative force and a wonderful human being, and the extraordinary universe he built alongside his best friend, Simon King, as the Hairy Bikers.
Lily Myers takes us on an intimate journey through life with Dave Myers, her beloved husband. She describes the joy of their wedding day, the camaraderie of friendships, and the challenges they faced during Dave's cancer diagnosis, their journey through treatment, and the final days they spent together. As well as a reflection on Lily's profound grief, this deeply moving memoir is a testament to the enduring power of love and the way she's found to celebrate Dave's life. Looking to the future, Lily offers readers a beacon of hope, sharing her coping strategies and the way she keeps Dave's memory alive.
I want that joy to be spread. Gosh, we need more positivity in this life and to see things in a multitude of colours, just like he did. Because of Dave, I view the world as beautiful. Who I am today is a result of my experiences with him and our 20 years together. I learn so much from him. I learn how to be free and happy, and I want to take that forward with me. I started writing shortly after he died of cancer at the age of 66 years old on 28th of February 2024, eager to get things down on the page while they were still fresh in my mind and unaltered by time. I wanted to paint the most accurate picture of who he was. As I tidied the house we shared, touching Dave's possessions and rediscovering items I'd not thought about in a long time, I was reminded of significant moments in our life and they would inspire me to write further. At first, my words were coming from acute pain, but with every line I put down, the hurt would lift a little. The more I expressed, the lighter I felt, and it started to feel like therapy. Reliving our most treasured memories has helped me process my grief. I'd urge anyone going through hard times to try writing about those experiences. It can be a way of clearing the mind, determining what needs healing, and diverting your thoughts into something positive. As a qualified life coach and hypnotherapist, I work with people in emotional turmoil. And since losing Dave, I've been able to use that knowledge and the tools from my training to help me find a way through. In profound grief, I've known when to step back, when to step forward, and when to ask for help if I've been depleted.
Dave and Me, Life With and Without My Hairy Biker by Lily Myers is in the RNIB Library as read by the author and runs for 8 hours and 18 minutes.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
For over 30 years, John Sushi was an ITN reporter and newscaster, covering world events like the Iran Revolution, the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, the Philippines Revolution, then presenting News at 10 and all ITN news bulletins. He then embarked on a second career as a presenter on Classic FM. He is a huge fan of Beethoven, writing 8 books on the composer. He was at Boswell with his latest book, In Search of Beethoven, his most personal book to date, dedicated to the life of this extraordinary composer. Part biography, part memoir, part travelogue, Sushi draws on his own life and career as a foreign correspondent and news anchor to show how Beethoven's music has accompanied him through the best and worst of times. It was with him as a music-loving and adventurous teenager, as a journalist entering Beirut in the grip of civil war, and as he has continued to explore the old cities of Bonn and Vienna in search of the man behind the music. John Sushi narrates the audio version.
At 5 p.m. on the 26th of March 1778, a stocky, powerfully built man walks out in front of a small audience in the Sternengasse in Cologne. He's dressed smartly, but uncomfortably. He might have borrowed the frock coat and breeches. They do not fit properly and look out of place on him. His abundant dark hair is scraped back and a thin pigtail falls across his collar. There are pockmarks on his face. But it is his eyes, open wide and blazing, that command attention. His jaw is set. Intensity and determination emanate from him, accentuated by the clenched fists at his side. The leonine head is thrust forward as he opens his mouth to speak. "I am Beethoven," he says, "and it is my honour to present my student, Mademoiselle Arverdonk, contralto singer at the princely court in Bonn. She will sing several beautiful arias. She will be accompanied at the piano, after which there will be several pieces played on piano alone. These will be performed by my son, who is greatly accomplished, even at the age of 6. Mademoiselle Arverdonk, smiling, ushers the small boy out in front of her. Ludwig van Beethoven, aged 7, not 6, is about to give his first public performance. Precisely 49 years later, to the day and the hour, as a storm breaks over Vienna, the most celebrated composer and musician in the world is about to draw his last breath.
I was here to talk about my latest book on Beethoven. It's called In Search of Beethoven, A Personal Journey. And it's by me, John Suchet, but it's not a biography of Beethoven. It's the story of how his life and music have become the great passion of my life.
On Thursday, the 8th of March, 1984, I stood at the railing of a passenger ferry as it pulled away from the dock at Limassol in Cyprus and turned east for the overnight journey to Beirut, capital city of a country in the grip of civil war. I was one of only 2 passengers on board. The other was a Danish businessman. Beyond initial salutations, we did not speak again. We knew that what we were doing was madness. Any sane person would be heading in the opposite direction.
And he accompanied you in some pretty hairy situations.
He's my constant companion. I used to be a reporter for ITN News before I became a newscaster, and he was in my pocket the whole time, particularly the Eroica Symphony. And I've covered, you know, as a reporter, some pretty awful, well, difficult stories like the Iran Revolution, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, Philippines Revolution, and Beethoven's Eroica is always with me wherever I go.
How did it help in those situations then?
There's something about his music that is inspirational uplifting. And if you listen to the Eroica in particular, it's a journey. It's like a novel, twists and turns. And by the end of it, that rush to the most amazing musical climax at the end. And at the end, you just feel, I can do anything. I can do anything. And that's the effect his music has on me.
Now, at the RNIB Talking Books Studios, we have a history of newsreaders reading their books, from Alvar Liddell to Richard Baker, Michael Aspel, and you read not only this audiobook, but all your books before. How have you found that process?
I love doing it because, you know, as a news reporter, you're broadcasting, you're using your voice the whole time, and to use it in a different way, like this, to read the books I've written, it's a different discipline, and it took me a while to work out how to do it, but I love doing it. I think talking books are, I read somewhere that talking books are the fastest growing branch of the publishing industry. More and more people are listening to them, and I have recorded this latest one with my voice, and I hope people enjoy that. It was great fun to do.
The air was crisp and fresh, the salt water spray invigorating. I imagined the sweet, exotic scent of the Middle East, although we were still some way out from Beirut. 4 hours later, in the twilight of dawn, I could see a distant red glow. My stomach churned with a mixture of fear and excitement. I was an ITN reporter en route to join my camera crew, who were already in the city. I was on one of the biggest stories in the world. I reached into my anorak pocket and pulled out my battered Walkman. In the other pocket was a single cassette tape, the only one I had with me, Beethoven's Symphony No. 3, The Eroica, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. I blew the sound into my ears. When it finished with that gloriously affirmative upward rush to the final chords, I played it again and again.
Now that it is in audio, it's accessible to people for whatever reason, be it sight loss, dyslexia, whatever reason, don't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Yes, very much so. I mean, I used to be a presenter on Classic FM radio, and we knew that a large proportion of our listeners were listening as they drive. And I've heard from a lot of people that they use talking books when they're driving. And that's amazing. I mean, it's what a great way to pass the time on a long journey. So there are so many more uses. I know they're very useful for people with impaired sight. I myself now, my eyes are not what they once were, and I find it very difficult to read books now. The print has to be so huge, it's ridiculous. But listening to a talking book in the car is amazing.
In Search of Beethoven, written and narrated by John Sushi, is available commercially, and many of his musical biographies are in the RNIB library, including Beethoven, The Man Revealed.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
What do Alexei Sale and Princess Diana have in common? They both just entered the RNIB library.
Thatcher Stole My Trousers by Alexei Sale was donated by Bloomsbury.
All his working life, my father was a railwayman. Through his older brothers, Joe Sale got a job on the old Cheshire Lions Committee at the age of 16, in the year before the general strike, and remained in the railway industry until he retired due to ill health in the late 1960s. The railways became so woven into our daily life that alongside communism, trains became our family credo. There weren't many problems we thought couldn't be solved either by the violent overthrow of capitalism or by getting on a train. In September 1971, I climbed aboard the sleek, jet plane-like carriage of a blue and grey intercity train that waited imperceptibly humming at the platform of Liverpool's Lime Street station, embarking on the most important journey of my life.
In 1971, comedians on the Working Minds Club circuit imagined that they would be free to continue telling their tired, racist, misogynistic gags forever. But their nemesis, a 19-year-old Marxist art student, was slowly coming to meet them. Thatcher Stole My Trousers chronicles a time when comedy and politics united in electrifying ways. Recounting the founding of the Comedy Store, the comic strip and the Young Ones, and Alexei's friendship with the comedians who, like him, would soon become household names, this is a unique and beguiling blend of social history and memoir. Fascinating, funny, angry and entertaining, it's a story of class and comedy, politics and love, fast cars and why it's difficult to foul a dwarf in a game of football.
I settled myself into a plastic foam and metal seat facing a wide table, gauzy orange curtains hanging at the window. In the buffet car, all the food came from a department of British Rail called Traveller's Fare, the spelling of fare implying that your food would be cooked by the Knights Templar and served to you by capering jesters, which indeed it often was. In a piece of almost Soviet centralisation, from the Highlands to Cornwall, every single item of refreshment in the buffet car was distributed via a central depot in the Midlands, so that all produce on the railways was stale days before it reached the customer. After a few minutes, the journey towards the capital began with a surge of electricity, and as we emerged from the sandstone tunnels that led out of Lime Street Station, I was able to get a good view of a piece of graffiti which had recently appeared, scrawled in paint on the wall by the side of the track. A missive which greeted each and every traveller coming from the south. It read in big black letters, "Off all Cockneys." This message remained untouched for the next 20 years, despite it being passed by endless maintenance crews, whose only action from time to time seemed to be to give it a fresh lick of paint. This rail journey to London was almost as routine for me as the bus ride to school or the ferry crossing over the River Mersey. Being the son of a railwayman meant I was entitled to free or reduced-price train travel right across Europe. So when I was a child, I'd frequently taken the four-hour journey with my parents to the capital, to march alongside them on political demonstrations, or to accompany Joe to trades union congresses at southern seaside resorts, or as the first leg of the continental rail trips we took every summer, firstly to France, Belgium and Holland, and then later further east to the communist countries of Czechoslovakia and Hungary.
Thatcher Stole My Trousers, written and read by Alexei Sale, is available from RNIB and runs for 10 hours and 15 minutes.
Diana World, An Obsession, by Edward White, was donated by Penguin Random House.
Of the various titles that Diana Spencer collected during her life, it is the unofficial one of the People's Princess that has most come to encapsulate her reputation. The origins of the term are contested. Many have claimed that Tony Blair's spin doctor, the shrewd, calculating Alastair Campbell, invented it. Others have said it arrived from Anthony Holden, a royal biographer and translator of ancient Greek poetry and Italian opera. Julie Burchill, a Republican iconoclast, perhaps best known for her writing about pop music, asserts that it was in fact she who bestowed the title upon Diana, in a laudatory article about the princess published in 1992. That credit for Diana's definitive sobriquet has been attributed to and claimed by such diverse figures is entirely fitting. In the half century of her existence as a public entity, Diana's mythology has been moulded, burnished, and appropriated by an enormous cast of people. When her former personal protection officer, Ken Wharf, published his reminiscences of Diana in 2017, he suggested that one of his motivations for doing so was that his old boss has increasingly been written out of history. It was a tendentious claim then, provably false now.
In February 1981, a 19-year-old nursery teacher's assistant overnight became globally famous. In a frenzy of excitement, jumping every barrier of language and class, a new overwhelming icon was conjured up. This is a guide to Diana World, the extraordinary hall of mirrors through which one young woman, the world's media, the royal family, and everybody else stalked one another. Fashion plate, breeder of heirs, role model, fantasy object, saint and sinner, Diana gripped the minds of millions of people in ways which were unique, complex, and distressing. After her death, chased by paparazzi through a Paris traffic tunnel, an estimated 2.5 billion people watched her funeral. Edward White examines Princess Diana as the complex figure she was, a scion of a great aristocratic house, wife of the future king, mother of his heirs, an inspiration and a delight to countless people for many years. And yet, of course, a human being, inevitably and woefully under-equipped either to deal with the horrors of the House of Windsor or control or even lightly supervise the Diana world she and others had created.
Of late, Diana has acquired a resurgent topicality. Key parts of her reputation, her rejection of deference, her questioning of institutional authority, her bridling against the way things are, seem very in keeping with the current age. Moreover, an audience of young adults, many not born until after her death, have rediscovered her through numerous television, film, and theatrical productions, reacting to the chapters of her life as though tuning in to breaking news events. The complication here is that so much of the fictionalized Diana is slathered in mythology, some belonging to Diana alone, some to an endless roll call of predecessors and antecedents stretching back centuries. This book is about those layers of mythology and the people connected to them. It is less a biography of Diana, more the story of a cultural obsession told via an exploration of Diana World. The sprawling, ever-evolving precinct of her various lives, public and private, real and imagined. It is a place inhabited by era-defining statesmen, as well as the most marginal figures in our society, of legendary performers, as well as outsider artists, of priests, poets, and drag queens. It features not only Dianaists, her supporters and advocates, but also her critics and adversaries. Each chapter of the book addresses Diana's connection with different communities, groups, and individuals who have, in some way or other, shaped her singular reputation.
Diana World, An Obsession by Edward White is in the RNIB Library as read by Josette Simon and runs for 13 hours and 58 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
A gift in your will is a really special way to continue supporting RNIB. Large or small, all gifts can have a huge impact on our services, as our work is vital and our services are needed more than ever. Over a third of the work we do is funded by the generosity of supporters who leave a gift in their will to RNIB. If you leave a legacy, you will make a significant difference to the lives of blind and partially sighted people, so their future is full of opportunity. Creating a will offers you the chance to make sure the people and causes you care about most are supported for years to come. We've made it easier for you to write or update your will with our free, accessible and simple will writing services. To find out more, please call 0303 123 9999 or go to rnib.org.uk/legacy.
And finally on today's show, Andrew O'Hagan gives us some book recommendations in Books of My Life.
Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Absolutely adored when I was growing up. A lot of children's books. First, you know, I was one of those kids who really, you know, learned how to think and how to express myself from reading, you know, books like The Little Prince or Charlotte's Web, The Railway Children, E. Nesbitt's fantastic Moving Story. These books gave me permission to feel and to express myself. You know, I couldn't believe the joy that those books brought me when I was very young. And I graduated from there to reading Dickens, Robert Louis Stevenson, A Young Age, Treasure Island, Kidnapped, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. These Stevenson novels seemed like miracles to me, actually miraculous, that you could send your mind and your heart into a strange, dark, but also strangely enlightening place. You came out the other end of this tunnel different. You were a different person. You were more fully formed. And I think that's what reading does for people. It gives them more of themselves and more of the world. So for me, oh, Stevenson. I mean, to this day, I can read a sentence of Stevenson's and I'm immediately transported back into this glittering world of the imagination.
The fire burned in the grate. A lamp was set lighted on the chimney shelf, for even in the houses the fog began to lie thickly. And there, close up to the warmth, sat Dr. Jekyll, looking deadly sick. He did not rise to meet his visitor, but held out a cold hand and bade him welcome in a changed voice. "And now," said Mr. Utterson, as soon as Poole had left them, "you have heard the news?" The doctor shuddered. "They were crying it in the square," he said. "I heard them in my dining room." "One word," said the lawyer. "Carew was my client, but so are you, and I want to know what I am doing. You have not been mad enough to hide this fellow." "Utterson, I swear to God," cried the doctor. "I swear to God I will never set eyes on him again. I bind my honour to you that I am done with him in this world. It is all at an end. And indeed, he does not want my help. You do not know him as I do. He is safe. He is quite safe. Mark my words. He will never more be heard of." The lawyer listened gloomily. He did not like his friend's feverish manner. "You seem pretty sure of him," said he. "And for your sake, I hope you may be right. If it came to a trial, your name might appear." "I am quite sure of him," replied Jekyll. "I have grounds for certainty that I cannot share with anyone. For there is one thing on which you may advise me. I have received a letter, and I am at a loss whether I should show it to the police. I should like to leave it in your hands, Utterson. You would judge wisely, I am sure. I have so great a trust in you." "You fear, I suppose, that it might lead to his detection?" asked the lawyer. "No," said the other. "I cannot say that I care what becomes of Hyde. I am quite done with him. I was thinking of my own character, which this hateful business has rather exposed." Utterson ruminated a while. He was surprised at his friend's selfishness, and yet relieved by it. "Well," said he at last, "let me see the letter."
The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and Other Tales of Terror by Robert Louis Stevenson. is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Rory Kinnear.
Is there a book on a rainy day that you could curl up with and reread?
Bleak House by Charles Dickens is my rainy day book. I could read that book multiple times and never get bored, never think, oh, I know what's going to happen, it's all fine, you know, forget it. No, in some cases I forget what's happened because I'm so involved in the moment-by-moment experience of the book. But even when I do know, I love the journey towards the revelation. Brilliant writing, brilliant humanity, amazing tolerance of difference, an amazing sense of human sensations, taste, smell, sight, hearing. You know, you taste that novel. If all your other senses were to blink out, you'd still experience that novel. You know, you could taste your way through Bleak House. Just a tremendous marvel of human imagination, you know. What a gift that just keeps giving.
London. Michaelmas term lately over, and the Lord Chancellor sitting in Lincoln's Inn Hall. Implacable November weather. As much mud in the streets as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth. And it would not be wonderful to meet a medulosaurus, 40 feet long or so, waddling like an elephantine lizard up Holborn Hill. Smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle, with flakes of soot in it as big as full-grown snowflakes, gone into mourning, one might imagine, for the death of the sun. Dogs, undistinguishable in mire. Horses, scarcely better, splashed to their very blinkers. Foot passengers, jostling one another's umbrellas in a general infection of ill temper, and losing their foothold at street corners, where tens of thousands of other foot passengers have been slipping and sliding since the day broke, if this day ever broke, adding new deposits to the crust upon crust of mud, sticking at those points tenaciously to the pavement, and accumulating at compound interest. Fog everywhere. Fog up the river, where it flows among green aits and meadows. Fog down the river, where it rolls defiled among the tiers of shipping, and the waterside pollutions of a great and dirty city. Fog on the Essex marshes. Fog on the Kentish heights. Fog creeping into the cabooses of collier brigs. Fog lying out on the yards and hovering in the rigging of great ships. Fog drooping on the gunwales of barges and small boats. Fog in the eyes and throats of ancient Greenwich pensioners, wheezing by the firesides of their wards. Fog in the stem and bowl of the afternoon pipe of the wrathful skipper, down in his close cabin. Fog cruelly pinching the toes and fingers of his shivering little prentice boy on deck. Chance people on the bridges peeping over the parapets into a nether sky of fog, with fog all round them, as if they were up in a balloon and hanging in the misty clouds.
That was the RNIB Talking Book version of Bleak House by Charles Dickens, as read by Maurice Turner.
Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
Well, I'd love to recommend a book by the poet and novelist Joe Dunthorne. It's called Children of Radium, and he goes in search of the story of his great-grandfather who worked as a chemist and had a certain position in Germany during the years when Germany was turning towards the darkness. And we don't know how involved he was. We certainly know he was a chemist whose experiments might have been used by the Nazis, but Joe has such a brilliant form of address. Comical, self-knowing, wry, friendly, warm, that you just go with him on this journey, and you know that round the next corner there might be a terrible revelation, but you still believe that you'd be on his side even so, and on his family's side, trying to deal with this terrifying time, this dark moment in history, which is somehow transmuted through Joe Dunthorne's wonderful literary personality. This is the guy who wrote Submarine, the novel a few years ago, which was adapted for film, and he wrote a great volume of poems, O Positive. This is his latest book, so I really highly recommend it to everybody, The Children of Radium.
My grandmother grew up brushing her teeth with radioactive toothpaste. The active ingredient was irradiated calcium carbonate, and her father was the chemist in charge of making it. Even before it was available in shops, he brought tubes home to his family. Under the brand name Doramad, it promised gums charged with new life energy and a smile blindingly white. Their apartment was so close to the factory that she fell asleep listening to the churning of the autoclave. When they were forced to leave Germany in 1935, they took tubes of it with them, their suitcases gently emitting alpha particles as they travelled 1,000 miles east. During the war, she learned that the toothpaste her Jewish father helped create had become the preferred choice of the German army. A branch factory in occupied Czechoslovakia ensured that the troops pushing eastwards, brutalizing and murdering, burning entire villages to the ground, could do so with radiant teeth. Not that she ever told me this. What I knew about my grandmother's life had all come secondhand, anecdotes worn smooth with each retelling. When my mother gave me a ring for my wedding, she told me it had escaped the Nazis in 1935. I looked at the oval bloodstone, black with flecks of red, picturing their getaway with the unique clarity of someone untroubled by having done any research. It was my uncle who gave me a poster of the smiling, yellow-haired Doramad girl, glowing from the inside. I pinned it above my desk and began to write about my grandmother's childhood. The project was going well until an intervention from the person whose actual life it was.
Children of Radium, A Buried Inheritance by Joe Dunthorne, is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by the author.
Andrew O'Hagan, thank you very much.
What a pleasure.
That's all we've got time for on today's Read On. We will be back at Boswell soon, but in the meantime, why not listen to our sister show, Talking Books? Every weekday, we showcase the best the RNIB library has to offer, but we're allowed to play on air. So enjoy a classic at 2pm or 10pm, Monday to Friday, or listen to every episode at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio, where you'll also find back episodes of Read On. Either way, I'll be back at the same time next week.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.